Hello again, everybody. This is James Bartley, and you're watching and listening to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. Today, my very special guest is Ted Rice, a close colleague and protege of Barbara Bartholek. We both had Barbara as mentors, essentially, along with Stuart Eglinton. And I want to welcome you both to the Cosmic Switchboard Show. And hello, Ted and Stuart. How are you?
Hey,
Hey,
great. Great to
Dave.
be here.
Thank you for inviting us to be on your show. It's a pleasure.
The pleasure is all mine. Like we were just saying before we started, all those years that we'd work with Barbie, and Barbie was like the ultimate spy master in many ways, where she was able to keep all these secrets, all this information in her head, and she, conducted herself so professionally and helped and healed so many people. And it's nostalgic for me talking to you because it brings back all the memories, the warm feelings I had just talking to her, and the kind of soothing kind of healing kind of aspect she had. Just talking to her, she had this way, of really calming you down, especially if you had a really rough night, alien abduction wise, So tell me, Ted, what have you been doing in the intervening years? And thank you so much, Stuart, for bringing Ted back into the fold. And also, Ted, just talk about some of your experiences and what brought you up to this point.
Oh, that I don't know where to start with it all. I what put me into seclusion, and I've told this before, but for your audience, we'll repeat that. Around the time that Carla Turner and I finished and published Masquerade of Angels, she had an experience with the men in black. And they actually came to her front door, knocked on the door. She goes to the door and they warn her. I don't know the exact verbiage, but she shared with me and Barbara. They told her that something bad would happen if she did not stop doing the work she was doing, which was being detrimental to them and their movement or their cause. And, excuse my very frank and vulgar language, but she told me, she said, I looked at him right in the face and I said, fuck off. And if you knew Carla, that's exactly what she would do in a case like that. And so at any rate, and then we move forward with that. Our Barbie got a couple of phone calls. I don't know how closely related they were to Carla's event, but she shared with Carla and I a couple of phone calls she had in which she was threatened because of her work. And she didn't use the same verbiage, of course, that Carla did, but she did say that she told them that she would not be intimidated by their threats. I was living in Shreveport, Louisiana at the time. And right before the Christmas holidays, I received a phone call during the night. I answered the phone, and it was a mechanical sounding, like almost like an unhuman talking, warned me that if I didn't want something bad to happen to my grandchildren, and I had two small grandchildren that I had taken custody of just a few months before that. So whoever was calling knew that I had these babies. And he told me if I didn't want anything bad to happening to them, that I had to put a zipper on my mouth. And I was at that time traveling around a few places. I had been a few places over in East Texas. Carla had arranged for me to go to Pensacola, Florida, and speak to a UFO group there, and a few other places. But working full time as I was and having children, I couldn't run off every weekend and do this. So I wasn't traveling around the country speaking as Carla was. But they warned me about this, and I shared this with Barbie and with Carla, and of course they were reassuring that we had to stand our ground. We must not, under any circumstances, cower down. But after I got threatened the second time, and the threat was a little more intense, and it still was a mechanical sounding, non-human voice, I did cower down. And I told Carla that I would not go around the area and be giving speeches on the weekend or talks about masquerade of angels. And then the next thing we know, Carla is diagnosed with this terminal cancer. And she believed that an incident that had happened up on a mountaintop there in Arkansas, in which she and her husband suddenly ran into a heavy fog, and then after this fog passed away, that some time had elapsed that they were not certain about. She thinks that they did do something to her at that time, and she shared that with Barbie and I, and we talked in detail about it. But at any rate, I decided that the welfare of my children was more important than talking about masquerade of angels at that time, and I didn't want to end up with terminal cancer. So I just, for a number of years, I just went into seclusion, in a manner of speaking. What I did was I stopped doing psychic readings. I didn't go out and do any lectures or talks, even though Carla wanted me to. I declined to do it. We were going to start working right away on a sequel to Masquerade of Angels because, with Barbie's help, we had enough information. But I refused at that time to do that. And so that's how I ended up in seclusion. I kept working, but I moved from Louisiana to another state, and just tried to live like a normal person as best I could. But even with that, James, a lot of people would find me and want me to talk or tell them more. I had a man who came. I believe, I suspected he was a government agent, wanted to know why I had stopped my work and if I was going back into the field after Carla's death. And he offered me a lot of money if I would more or less arrange all this or let him manage this in my life. And I had to sign a contract for this. There was no actual amount of money set, but he said the amount would be unlimited to my needs, and I would have anything I wanted. Well, that's very appealing, very appetizing, but I turned it down. And so for a number of years, but hey, I'm 81 years old now. My health is not all that good. My babies are adults. They have their own lives, their own families. There's so much more information out there now coming from all directions, all walks of life, all different countries. I'm not intimidated or afraid as I was at that time. And as I begin to feel this, I suddenly get a contact from our friend here, Stuart, and he says, "Hey, let's do this." And of course, I'll let him tell you more in detail. I don't remember his exact wordage or verbiage here, but I just felt within my inner being it was time for me to tell what I knew, and I just felt I was ready. And he is the person who opened the door. So I have to give him credit for that.
Ted, can I just on Carla Turner's book, it says, for the record, this isn't exactly what it says, but about what it says, for the record, Carla died of cancer. Okay.
Yes.
But you're saying that it was inflicted by the aliens, essentially.
She suspected that.
Yeah, okay.
I
Did
mean,
Elton believe?
there was no proof do that, and she did not get to, because of the sickness, she did not get to Barbara to go under hypnosis to look at it. They wanted to do that to see if she could find some evidence. But now Elton, her husband, he did not feel that anything happened to them on that mountaintop. If he did, he was totally what's the word? I want to say, like, denied.
Oblivious.
Yeah, he didn't see anything, remember anything at all, and so he couldn't validate anything. Carla, on the other hand, said that there was like 20 or 30 minutes of time there that they were very uncertain about. Elton said, well, it could be because we were in all of a sudden entrapped there. We didn't even know exactly where we were in the sparse light. We ran into a fog so dense that we couldn't even see our hands in our face. That's all I know about it. She suspected that something was done to her at that time.
Right,
Like to
okay.
interject
But also.
I want to throw something out there. In Masquerade, I wrote about, and our Carla wrote out together, we did, about a fog and people experiencing this fog, and something good would come out of it. Doesn't mean that something bad also couldn't come out of it. Carla's description to me was this was an unusual type of fog. It was not like you could walk outside in your yard and it was so foggy you couldn't see the shrubbery or trees, but she said this fog was that blinding. And so she was suspicious. I was suspicious because of the nature of this fog.
I got a little to add to that, and off camera we can talk more about it sometime. But Barbara introduced me to a gal who I'd gotten to know subsequently very well, and she'd had alien abduction experiences, and she said that he was on board the craft or in an installation somewhere where the ETs were doing some kind of medical procedure to Carla's kidney, right? Or her liver, or that part of her anatomy. And she woke up from that experience quite shaken. And then later on, Carla is diagnosed with cancer and then passes away, as you know. And this gal calls up Barbie heartbroken and guilt-ridden for some reason, feeling that somehow she was involved or responsible for Carla's getting cancer and dying. But what really happened was she was there taken as an abductee. Her and Carla had actually been corresponding for some time, working on implant research together and alien abduction research together. And she was on board the craft or in this installation, and she saw these ETs doing something to Carla's side. And eventually, that's where the cancer formed. Later, out of respect for this gal's family, who are not aware of this, I can't mention her name, but she was a close friend and a colleague introduced to me by Barbara. My friend eventually died. She was abducted by the reptilians. They tortured her. They broke a vertebrae in her neck, and then eventually, she suffered a heart attack and passed away. So she was another person that was involved in this, but had died. Now, what happened was Barbara was so intrigued by her account, calling Barbara up heartbroken and guilt-ridden. Barbara flew to Arizona to regress her, this gal. And just all kinds of weird things happened in the house that Barbara was staying at, where the regressions were taking place. The place turned out to be haunted. All kinds of strange things were going on. But in this process, Barbara, which she never usually does, from what I understand, she introduced me to this gal that I've been talking about, and she and I became good friends. And and research colleague over the years until this thing happened where the reptilians got a hold of her. They suspended her upside down. They tortured her and they broke her neck, basically. And then he was scheduled to have a neck surgery. And then in the days leading up to the neck surgery, she had a heart attack, went into a coma, and eventually passed away. And I got to see her before she died when she was in the hospital. So I think it was a great thing that you took time off, took a sabbatical, a well-earned rest, Ted, because sometimes you do have to step back from this. And there were times when Barbara and I were on the phone, there was so much interference, so much screeching, interference noise that no matter how loud or how much I screamed and yelled at the top of my voice, she couldn't hear me. I couldn't hear her. We had to hang up, call each other again. The same shrieking sound would happen. Things like that happen. And as you know, so many things happened to Barbara too. How they,
Oh,
the ETs
absolutely.
destroyed her yacht that she and Bob were working to restore. Please continue.
Right, it burned. It burned out in the yard. But I want to validate your Arizona friend and what happened. Barbara shared that story with me. Now, she didn't identify her, but everything you've just said, Barbara told me herself about that case. And actually, Barbara told me she left Arizona and came back because of fear. Because so much was going on, and
That's
she
right.
felt they were attacking her, that she actually kind of fled and returned home to get away from it.
Yes, a quick interjection because it's coming back to me now. Barbara, if you recall, said that her and Bob drove cross country, and it seemed like every other mile there was a problem with a car overheating, breaking down,
Absolutely.
et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely.
And then when they were chased out of that house, which was haunted, weird things happened. If memory serves, tree falling over in the front yard. Eventually, Barbara and Bob said, "We've had enough." They get into their car, and wouldn't you know it, from Arizona all the way back to Tulsa, they didn't have one breakdown or one problem with the car.
Right, absolutely. And as far as the screeching on the phone you experienced with Barbie, I have shared that with Stuart. Barbara and I, we had so much interference. And all these years that I had been in seclusion, that Barbara, and of course, I was daily contact with Carla as long as she lived and was able to talk. We had a very close relationship. Barbara and I continued our work. I made numerous trips to Tulsa during these years. Nobody knew about it, but we were continuing our work. And if you want to know about your friend in Arizona feeling guilty that she may have contributed something to Carla's death, let me tell you how I feel about Barbara's death. Barbara had talked me into getting a transfer with my employment to Tulsa so that we could start with the sequel to Masquerade of Angels. We had probably enough to write 500 pages in regressions and information. My children had grown up, and it was a time that I could do it, and I agreed to do it. I put in the transfer at my job. It was accepted. And very shortly after that, Barbara died, or Barbara was in this horrible accident. And I felt like, or I still feel like, if I had said, no, we're not going to do this, Barbara might still be alive today. So I know that feeling.
Yes, there was just talking about this in that period of time, and then seeing the front page headline in the local Tulsa paper of that white car that I'm sure you've ridden in as I have, that Barb and
And
Bob
Bob.
used to drive around in,
Yeah.
and then to see that picture in the Tulsa newspaper. Of the car sitting on top of Barbie and her legs sticking out underneath, right?
Right.
And then the whole circumstance of how she was rear-ended by a guy going 120 miles an hour, and the guy gets up and walks out, right? Like, I mean, who can do that, or what can do that, right? So, it was And then also how they were playing with her blood pressure. You remember, like, she would go into the ER and then they would tell her, there's no way you should be alive. It is high as your
I
blood
know.
pressure is right now. So they were doing something to her, raising her blood pressure to extremely dangerous levels. So she was under a lot of harassment. And I want to mention also that what Carla told me, see, I was the one that made arrangements for Candy to come to San Diego and give a couple of lectures there, right? I felt the time was right, like Stuart felt, like, reaching out to you. I felt the time was right to get Carla out there. So I was with the San Diego UFO Society at the time, made arrangements for Candy to come out, give a couple of lectures. And Candy and I crossed paths a few times over the years at conferences and whatnot. And what Carla told me was, like you just said, Masquerade of Angels was supposed to be just the first of a number of volumes. There was so much information that had been amassed in your work with Barbie and with Carla that the work necessitated a number of volumes, but of course that never came to pass. But like you're saying, you still have a lot of the information, right? Now, one of the things Barbara mentioned to me was there was a whole aspect of cloning that you were going to really delve into in the second book. Did you want to
Yes.
talk about the parts of the second book which should have come out had not all this happened, right? And then then we can just go from there, wherever you want to go, Ted.
Oh, okay. Well, I have talked so much in the past already about cloning. I
Before we go, do you guys hear a pinging noise?
no.
I'm hearing it. Again, this is a new computer. My previous one died, so I'm just learning the nuances of it. So that could be coming from my end, but I just recorded an interview with someone the other day and I didn't have this problem. So
Yeah.
let's try to
See,
muddle through.
when me and Ted are talking, we get these noises that come through. Sometimes it's like just a telephone ringing, and there's no telephone in either of our rooms, that's actually ringing, but we can hear it through the speakers.
Yes. I mean, it's one thing for people to get interference and harassment by deep black elements of the military and government, which is bad enough. But when the interference comes from the aliens themselves, right? There's a whole series of weird paranormal spiritual warfare reprisal events occur. And it's not a coincidence. As time goes on, you realize that this is deliberate. But anyway, please continue.
Ted, sorry, you were going on about cloning, Ted. Sorry.
Well, I mean, there's been so much about that. I hate to just talk about the same thing, but what I saw in that UFO, and there I was. This was the abduction where I was probably around 8 years old. And I was, we were, my family and I were living out in a rural area on a farm owned by my grandmother. It was probably a 300 to 500 acre farm. They had big fields of cotton and all kind of products. I was crossing this field, going from my grandmother's house across the cotton field to another area of the farm where we lived. And it was a very cloudy, balmy day. Very stormy looking, dark clouds. And as I'm cro it hasn't it wasn't raining yet, but as I crossed this field, I stopped and I looked up at the dark clouds above me. And shining through that dark cloud was a light so bright it was blinding. And I remembered that without being under hypnosis. I talked to Carla about it, and I said, this is one of the reasons I want to look at that. I remember that all my life, but I didn't remember anything else other than stopping and looking at that light. Now we move on to the regression with Barbara. Under that, I saw myself be floating up in a beam of light coming out of that dark cloud. And I just very slowly, like riding an elevator, went right up. As I got into the bottom of the cloud, There was like a big grate, like an iron gate, like at someone's yard, you know. And it was a grate there, but you went through the floor. Now, the grate appeared to be like solid metal, but yet I passed right through it. And that was puzzling to me. I don't know if I've ever talked about that part before or not. But then I'm inside a small room, and there are three funny looking little characters that I now know as Greys. And they said something to me. I heard them in my head, and of course now I'm a child. I started answering them verbally, and they very quickly said, "Don't do that. That hurts our hurts us. Say nothing. Just say it in your mind, and we will hear you." So we started then communicating in English back and forth. Told me where to sit, and I sit, and I looked out the window, and I could see my grandmother's house, and we were above it. And we then began to accelerate and go above the clouds, and I saw the sun above the clouds. It was light, but never experienced an airplane or anything. I didn't really comprehend at my age what was going on, but I'm telling you what I saw. Then we kept going further and further away until it kept getting darker and darker and darker. I'm assuming, and I've shared this before, we were going into space, but we were going extremely fast, and then I could see out this window something that looked like a huge blimp, but it was metallic looking, but it was tremendous inside, and there were little portals, and I could see little tiny things that looked like in the distance like little gnats or little flies going in and out of these portals on this huge whatever it was. And I now say I think that was a mothership. And as we got closer, I saw that these little gnat looking or fly looking things were actually some type of vehicle going in different portals. So they were coming from all directions, and there were mass numbers of them coming and going. We go into one of the portals, and we sit down and we park, and I'm taken out, and then I'm taken into a room where there's right at the moment I'm going to say there's two characters. There is a little small human-looking nurse. She's wearing a nurse's gown or uniform and a little nurse's cap, and she has straight burgundy-colored red hair. She has funny-looking lipstick and rouge. At first, I thought she was human. Standing in there with her, giving her directions or orders, was a taller figure than her, but not much taller. Dressed, had real Dracula-looking shaped hair, like a widow's peak hair. Also had on makeup that made him look white. He had on a blue and white jumper suit attire. He had a purple and green, dazzling in color, almost sparkled robe hanging from his shoulders. And he was giving her directions, so he was in charge. She made me, reluctantly on my part, get naked. I had no clothes. I was stood up in front of a metal, like looked like sheet metal, plate on the wall, and when it was activated, then it lit up and there were all kind of lines in it, flashes of light, all different kind of things going on. So this metal sheet in detail here actually turned out to look more like a TV screen once it was activated. But I'm not seeing a TV show, but I'm seeing the veins in my body. I'm seeing the shape of my brain beyond the skull. I'm seeing all kinds of things in this screen there. And later, I told Barbara, and this was in another abduction where we looked more at this. I said, it's counting every hair on my head. It's counting and recording every freckle on my body, every mole, every bump, every scar. It's imaging everything there is about me. And after that was done, then I was made climb up on a table, like it looked like a regular doctor's examination table, and I sit there for a little bit, and then finally, the nurse comes over, and by the way, this nurse under the second regression, I could see her more clearly, and she or he or whatever it was actually a small gray dressed like a little human nurse to keep me from being as frightened. The larger character that I saw, instead of looking like Count Dracula, actually was a taller gray with all this garb on and this makeup to make him look human as possible.
I thought Count Dracula is interesting because what is alien abduction? It's a form of vampirism. And then this gray chose to appear as a vampire.
Yeah, well, I didn't think of him as a vampire at that time, but I can see, the characteristics there that would make you think that, and maybe that is where Count Dracula actually came from when it got installed into humanity, as witnesses that had also been through what I'm describing here to you.
And
But
Dracula
it,
could turn into mist.
yes. And so moving on from there, the nurse brings me in a like a little cup is some green liquid, which was probably equivalent to about a third of a cup of liquid, maybe a little more. And it's the room is kind of dark. This is an interesting thing you may find interesting here, is there were no light fixtures anywhere. The entire place simply just was a natural illumination. It was some type of energy in the air that made it light just naturally. And everything had just a tiny bit of a blue hue to it. Okay. So there were no wall switches. There were no lamps. There were no light fixtures anywhere. The atmosphere itself simply glowed that color where you could see. She brings me this green liquid and tells me that I must drink it, and I refuse to drink it. I said, no, I want to go home. She says to me, if you want to go home and see your mother again, then you have to drink this liquid or you'll never go home again. So reluctantly, I drank it. And just as soon as I drank it, I felt like my entire insides were being eat up by an acid or fire or something. It was extreme burning sensation, like I was just burning alive. And then I remembered seeing myself cough up some of the liquid and it dripped from my chin. And then, they lay me over flat And then I felt myself take my last breath. It all happened very quickly. There was no delay in this. It all happened within, after I drank that liquid, it all happened within, I would say within seconds, 30 seconds, 45 seconds at the most. And it was over. And then I saw, and now I'm looking at this like third person because Barbara has me under hypnosis. So and she had me viewing this as an observer, so, rather than actually living it over again. She had me observing what was happening to me to help contain the fear. And she had learned that this worked better to do that, but you get the same results, according to her. So I see, first I see a shadowy, ethereal-looking figure rise up out of my little body and stand up. And I'm thinking possibly the Dracula guy escorted that figure over to the side. I didn't see it again. And under hypnosis, we couldn't find it again. But I saw that figure. And then I saw rise up behind that, a glowing, brilliant light came out of my body that was as brilliant as that light that pulled me up into that dark cloud. It was absolutely blinding. And it was a mass of it. And I could not find under hypnosis that it had any consciousness it may have. I felt that it had a totally just a mass of love. And I told Barbara at that time, I said, it's an energy field of pure love. I said, I think it's the God spark is in all of us. And so the next thing I know, they put a little black box on my chest and they activate this little black box. And I watch this mass I'm describing to you as the God spark being coiled into the inside of this little box. And then the little box is unplugged and they take the little box with that in it and they take it away over to the side somewhere. I'm not sure where it went from there. The next thing I know is I'm in a corridor walking down like a highway, and I could hear this drumming or beating kind of sound, like some dull machinery in the background. And as we get closer, I begin to have panic attacks. So Barbara and I had to back up. We had to reapproach this situation. A little more cautiously, and Barbara had to talk to me and get me more ready to meet what was making this noise. Finally, we get there, and I'm able to see it. And it is rows and rows and rows. And when I say rows, it's like you can't see the end of it down this corridor. And these are their vats or tubs. And Barbara has me look inside to see what's inside these tubs. And of course, I panic again. But finally, I'm able to look and I see inside these tubs are little human fetuses. And I'm going to say there was four to six in each tub. And the tub was altered or manufactured in a way that the end of it had the uterus of a cow. So these fetuses were birthed like they actually birthed in a human mother through these artificial vaginas. And I watched one being birthed out of that, and then they took it away. They brought it to life. It cried. I saw it. I witnessed it, and they took it away. And so,
Why did they use the cow uterus and not a human uterus?
Well, to use the humans, first of all, from what I understand from Linda Moulton Howe, bovines are genetically very susceptible to human blood, so they can keep these fetuses in there for psychological reasons. They birth it so that the fetus will actually experience a birth psychologically. I don't under the details of why, but that was the reason. That was what came up with me in talking to Barbara. She asked the same thing. My opinion was, since there were thousands of these things, because they're manufacturing these from all over the planet, they're mass numbers of them, so it's big business. If they had all these women fetuses, or excuse me, had all these fetuses being birthed from human bodies, I would imagine they would be. They remember these tubs, these vents. They're not human. They are products that have been manufactured. To have human women birthing these, they would have to take care of all these women. That was, I think, lying within there somewhere is the real reason for this. But, as I've said to you, Stuart, and many other people, I am a witness. I'm telling you what I saw with Barbara's help, what I saw. And I'm not telling you or anybody that I know it's 100% true, because I'm just a witness. You have a car accident on the highway, and you've got five witnesses, and everybody's story is going to have a variation slightly. And not everybody that saw what I saw may tell the same story, but this is what Ted saw. And so that is the cloning. Now, what's the reason for the cloning? I believe the reason for the cloning is these reptilians and these greys and these mantis, and God only knows what other creatures, because I saw other indescribable creatures while I was there. They're feeding, we are farm-raised food for them. This is big business for them. And I think I'm witness to what's going on. And I think whatever took me there was ready for these truths to come out, because of the demonic nature of it all. And for us to progress in this world, we've reached a point, in my opinion, where we have to start seeing the truth. As long as we believe in Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy and all these things, then we're living a lie. And as horrible as what I witnessed, it may be the truth, and we have to start looking at these possibilities in order for us to move forward as a human species. If we stay blinded by the light, we're not going to ever wake up to reality and find out why Israel is at war, why the Ukraine is at war, what's the driving force that created these scenarios in humanity where this is taking place, because there's some invisible force feeding off of the energy of it. And they need that for their existence. And if we're going to wake up to that reality and change everything, then we got to know what we're fighting. And I believe that that's why I've seen what I've seen. What else would you
Please.
like for me to share about the cloning?
Oh, well, that's key, and also what you've observed of the reptilians, because Barbara and I Carl and I and others have, Eve Lorgan and I have had discussions about the underground processing plants, as Barbie called them, these areas underground where the reptilians and other ETs have this large farming operation where countless humans, literally countless humans of all ages, especially children, are being harvested for their fluids, for their meat products, for their energy, et cetera. In the discussions you had with Barbie, what did you learn about that, and how did that tie in perhaps with what you just described and what you just talked about, the farming aspect of it all?
Well, you got to understand out there in space and perhaps under the ocean, there's some huge motherships that house numerous numbers of these species of aliens. And they're feeding on our energy, in my opinion. The light that I talked that illuminated the ship. It comes off of human energy that they have siphoned off, and they know how to use mass doses of it to light the, because they don't have electricity. And then you've got and we have all these people that think these reptilians are our friends. The mantis are our friends. I've been told the mantis are the caretakers of the children that they're seeing after. But nobody stops to ask themselves, what are these creatures eating? What's their food source? And nobody wants to believe that I've witnessed mantis eating on like a buffet line, where they're eating children's livers and hearts and internal organs. They're feeding on them. And I witnessed this. I saw it firsthand. And Barbara had a hard time with me when I'd see these things. It was all I could do to keep from just going absolutely crazy. I mean, it went against everything that I believed in my life. And I
Yeah.
didn't, I didn't want to know these things.
Yeah.
I truly didn't want to know it.
Ted, let me ask you, why don't they just eat the cloned bodies and not the free-range humans that are walking around?
Well, the clone bodies haven't been out grazing. They don't have any material. It's just like a newborn baby that's just been birthed. It hasn't been eating any protein. It's been living, off of the fluids inside its mother's body. They want nutrition. They want minerals. They want, and not only that, they want the energy that our soul creates. Like they can't feel. Oh, let me tell you, one of the things I screamed at it with Barbie first time, and I said, these people, these beings, they have no feeling. It's dead. There's no emotion. They don't care if you live or die or if you're burning alive. It doesn't matter to them at all. They have no feeling whatsoever. Until you've been in the presence of that, you don't know what demons are. You have no idea what it feels like. And it's god awful. It is. It's so frightening. And they want this energy off of us. They want our flesh that's rich in nutriments. And we don't know what all they're getting there that from it that we're not aware of too. It's like our friend Janet said to me, well, fresh veal is quite delicious. Well, I'm sure there is something coming out of it, or the mantis wouldn't be feeding on those babies,
Yeah, specifically children.
specifically children. So they're getting something out of it. But I don't know the answer to all that. I just know I saw at Dulce, when I was taken to the underground base there, I witnessed people being brought in small crowds, and they were in zombie land. They were like frozen on pause. And I saw and went up close to a beautiful young lady and her son. And I watched them being stripped from their clothing and rolled into the slaughterhouse. And I heard their bodies being ripped apart. Now, this has been very hard for me, people, but I'm telling you what I witnessed, and this is what I saw. I'm not going to paint you a pretty picture when I didn't see one.
Can you tell us the circumstances, what you remember of how you wound up at Dulce on that occasion, and if you'd been there more than once? Do you remember being abducted and being taken there?
I don't think that I don't think that I've been there more than once, but I could have. But I'm living in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I'm living across the mesa from Kirtland Air Force Base. And night, I'm taken through the I'm living in an RV. The top of the RV opens, and I can see above me, and above me is like a dark spot in the darkness. And I remember rising up, and I began to panic because I had experienced that sensation before, and I knew it was not going to be good. But I was put inside this small craft, very similar to what I've been put in before. And we went flying into and over Kirtland, and we went into a hole in the mountainside behind Kirtland Air Force Base. I could see the military buildings and military jeeps and things down below as we flew right over them. And then when we got inside this, like this mine shaft or whatever, then all of a sudden it accelerated and we were traveling like in a tunnel at supersonic speed. I could see lights just flashing like lightning passing by me. And then it was very quick, maybe 25 seconds, 30 seconds. And then we were at Dulce. And of course, Dulce is not very far from Albuquerque. What, 30 miles, 35 miles, maybe? Then, we go through this portal into like a mountainside. And then we're in like a big room. And then I'm taken out of the crowd and I witness these things that are happening. Now, an interesting thing that amazed Barbara and Carla was that the caretakers in charge or the workers in charge in there, as these humans were brought in these little crafts, were tall, blonde, blue-eyed men, Nordic, I would say, and they were wearing on their military green, I think they had the swastika on their arms. And, that's all I could say about them, other than they were not very kind. They didn't seem to have any feeling much, if any. The passengers, the people that were being brought in, especially like this woman and her son that I told you about, they jerked them around like, of course, the people, they were like frozen. They were on pause. I don't know how to describe it, but in zombie land, but they were still breathing. They were alive. But they jerked them around. They could have broken their arms the way they were handling them, and they just ripped their clothes off from them. And then inside, and I told Barbara, and Barbara said, "Oh my God," she said, "I've had other abductees who have mentioned this, but nobody ever knew what this was." But I said, "I hear this very dull ripping kind of noise." And she had me move closer into that room where I actually saw what this kind of dull ripping noise was. And what it was is they had removed, severed the limbs from these bodies, these human bodies, and the torso was hanging on like meat hooks. And they took some type of contraption and put it around the backbone up near where the neck was in, and then they jerked it and filleted the human.
Now, I know that you're saying that it was the Nordics, okay? But I've heard other accounts where people are seeing Nordics in similar situations, but they're not really Nordics. It's like there's like a holographic screen over the face, and what's behind the face are reptilians.
That's
Is it
possible.
you think it's reptilians though? Is it the Nordics or
Well,
the reptilians?
I don't think the I'm not sure that the reptilians or the greys are strong enough to manhandle those humans like these were.
Really?
Yes. Because some of the passengers brought in were heavy, they were big men. And you know, these reptilians that I've seen are not normally that big. However, these draconians, they're pretty big in size. So if it was some of them posing as Nordics, it's possible. But I just that was a point that I had pointed out to Barbara was I haven't seen a gray or reptilian that I've seen that's big enough to handle those humans like they're doing. Because they could pick up a man who probably weighed 200 or more pounds with one hand. They
See,
were
my point,
extremely powerful.
we've got apparently so many different alien races here, okay? Hundreds of different types. I think it's more likely that there's just a couple, and the Nordics, I know they're reported in a lot of experiences, but I'm not convinced they really do exist. I think it's like an identity that the reptilians are using
It's possible.
to mislead people. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you, Ted.
Well, that's possible. I wouldn't rule that out because and if I had been able to go back to Dulce under hypnosis, Barbara, again, we probably would have seen a little more. Because every time we would look at the same situation, like the cloning, you know, it took three, maybe four trips under hypnosis, Barbara, to see all those details in that cloning that I've just described to you. I didn't see all that the first time. So it's highly possible if I had been able to go under hypnosis again, I may have seen more about Dulce that may validate what you're saying about the Nordics.
There's another important aspect to the cloning, okay? Me and Ted did an episode about a policeman who was abducted. Ted, do you remember his name? It was
Ooh.
I'll look it up in a second
Oh,
for everyone, okay?
yeah.
But you picked it out specifically because now, if you're reading this story, okay, a policeman, he sees a light in the field. He goes over to it. He ends up getting abducted. The ETs take him up on board the craft. There's a medical procedure performed, and he's thanked for helping them on their mission. It was a load of greys, and eventually he's put back. Okay, now we picked out that story because
His name
there
was
was,
Herbert Schimmer.
yeah, that's it, that's it. Yeah, sorry, I was trying to look it up there while I was talking, but we picked out that story. Okay. Because Ted, you saw key details in his abduction account where a cloning had taken place. He had seen this machine, which you had also seen in your own experiences. Now, he didn't connect it to cloning. He just kind of thought it was just a random part of the ship. Do you remember that case, do you?
Oh, absolutely. I remember. Yes. I selected that because it followed the pattern. You see, these cloning procedures of these abductions follow similar patterns in almost all of them. If you get all the details together, but when you get people that get a little bit here and a little bit there, and then it's all flowered over with screen memories, that's why we don't all agree on everything. If you follow what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, like, for an example, everyone's familiar with the Betty and Barney Hill case, okay? But does anyone really believe that these ETs just landed, picked them out, gave them a mouth exam and an eye exam and examined wherever else, and then had a conversation about this galactic empire with trade routes? And yes, you can keep this book, even though it doesn't make any sense to you, and then they're not allowed to keep the book. Does anyone believe that that's what really happened? I think it's more likely that Betty and Barney Hill were taken. They were cloned, so their bodies were destroyed, their essence were put into new bodies. They were harvested and then sent on their way again to go out and collect nutrients in the body.
Right, with screen memory stories to lead
Yeah.
them forward.
And that's what they came back with. And everyone in the, like, Betty and Barney Hill case is a famous case. That's why I brought it up. But Ted, going back to Herbert Shimmer, what are the things for people to look out for in these cases of cloning?
Okay, well, first thing they're going to do is they're going to make you feel important. They play on your ego. And if you look at so many of these abduction cases, people are made to feel like they're special, they're important. And they led this policeman into their craft, feeling like they wanted to show him about their craft. They wanted to learn, they wanted him to learn. It was all sweet. And then they make pictures, they get him standing in front of this, sheet metal screen, like I was talking about. And of course, with the screen memories, he doesn't see it the same way that I did. But the nature of what it was doing, according to him, was very similar to what I've said they're doing. And you know, they're copying, and they copy. And even in the Bible, it says in there that every hair is numbered. And I see that as a clue that our people ahead of us, behind us many years ago, were more aware of some things than we've been allowed to know, if you follow what I'm trying to say. And if you see my drift in what I'm trying to say here about every hair is numbered. But as far as Shimmer goes here, you know, if you look at the steps and compare them, if you look at his the podcast where we did about him, and I describe all of it, you can follow it very closely and see how that relates to what has happened to me.
Yeah.
Well, we got left in this first segment, and it's been a fascinating discussion. I'm starting to remember some of the details of the Herbert Shimmer case. He said he was scanned head to toe with some kind of device. Yeah, and they did something similar to him that they did to Barney and Betty Hill, where they showed him screen, television screens, and it showed various star systems, et cetera, et cetera. And they did talk about trade routes, if memory serves, similar to what Betty and Barney Hill were told. And what's interesting is the beings, if memory serves, that Herbert Shimmer encountered claims where it was inferred somehow that they were from the Zeta Reticuli star system also. So, and there's a whole lore, a whole backstory about Zeta Reticulians and their role in the whole abduction phenomena. Well, we reached the end of a fascinating first segment with our guests Ted Rice and Stuart Eglinton. Stuart and Ted, if people want to get a hold of you and share their stories, how would they do that?
Stuart, go
Well,
ahead.
yeah, we were listen. We're on most platforms. We're on Spotify, iTunes. We're on YouTube as well. So people can check us out there. If anyone wants to email us, they can email me. It's Stuart89T@yahoo.com.au. Okay, so Stuart89T@yahoo.com.au.
Now, for our dear listeners out there, if you like what we do, if you believe in what we do, please go to the cosmicswitchboard.com, sign up and become a member, and we'll see you at the top of the next segment.